Camp Claiborne and the Bohunks and Golems of Camp Ellis, he could not conceal the caliber of his game as a soldier and an engineer. He was strong and durable. His frugality with words got interpreted variously, but to his advantage as manliness, self-possession, imperviousness. Inevitably, word got around that he held an engineering degree from Drexel Tech, spoke fluent German, was all but unbeatable at pool, and on intimate terms with motors, batteries, and radios. One afternoon, when he and his fellow trainees were out butchering a meadow along the Spoon River, some idiot drove a truck through the line that connected their field telephone to the switchboard. My grandfather improvised a new connection using a nearby barbed wire fence. When it started to rain and the wet fence posts grounded the line, he cut a spare inner tube into foldable bits and sent men down along the fence for 2 miles to insulate wire from wood. The next day he was ordered to report to the commanding officer of his cadre. The major was a lean Princetonian, stained and yellowed by years of spanning chasms and draining swamps in malarial climes. His cheeks were all peeling skin and gin blossoms. He filled a briar pipe and took his time about it. Every now and then he sneaked a sidelong look at my grandfather, who stood uncomfortably at ease, wondering what he had done wrong. After the major had set fire to his pipe, he informed my grandfather that he was to be recommended for transfer to the Corps' Officer Candidate School at Fort Belvoir, Virginia. The atmosphere of life as an enlisted man was toxic with disdain for officers, and from the first, my grandfather had breathed that atmosphere freely, without need of filter or adjustment period. "Sir," my grandfather replied after a moment of irresolution. He had nothing against this particular major. It was officers as a class whom he despised. "I'll swing a hammer until we built a highway from here to Berlin, but all due respect, I'd rather be a dancing chicken in a box on the steel pier than a commissioned officer." "No offense, sir."
"None taken. I understand what you're saying. And between you and me, you're dancing chicken analogy is very close to the mark."
"Sir? All the same, are you aware that if you were to make the grade as a first lieutenant, it would add $50 to your monthly soldier's pay?" It happened that my great-grandfather's final enterprise, a lunch counter near Scheid Park, had recently gone under. He was working now at a package store, grappling in a hernia truss with steel kegs of Yinlin. For years, my great-grandmother had taken in piecework, sewing ribbon and trim for a milliner. Now she had been obliged to get a job outside the house, boxing cakes and pastries in a bakery, where the bakers, two half-brothers, burned off their mutual contempt by abusing the counter-help. My grandfather knew that his parents would shoulder any work and stomach any companions to pay the upkeep on Ray's education, in which they lodged their dreams.
"No, sir," he said, "I was not aware of that."
2 weeks later, the day before the men of his cadre boarded a train for Dawson Creek, B.C., where they pitched in to work on the Alaskan Highway, my grandfather was ordered to report to the Corps OCS at Fort Belvoir. It was a bitter journey. Far from the frozen north or the war's early battlefields, 3 hours from Shunk Street, more bored than ever, my grandfather began to brood. His years in pool rooms and classrooms inclined him to divide men into patsies, idiots, and shams, and there was little evidence at Fort Belvoir to debunk this taxonomy. Everywhere he looked, he discovered laziness, incompetence, waste, bluster. In other soldiers' hearts, such discoveries bred cynicism, but in my grandfather's, there arose a more or less permanent state of aggravation. Given the proximity of Fort Belvoir to Washington, D.C., it was only a matter of time before his exasperation generalized beyond the perimeter fence to encompass the seat of government itself. In spite of Pearl Harbor and the invasion panics it inspired, the capital had yet to lose its complacency toward enemies who were continents and oceans away. Anti-aircraft batteries were spotty. Elderly Curtiss biplanes patrolled sputtering overhead. A handful of Coast Guard tubs policed the rivers and bridges.
Walking the streets one afternoon on a one-day pass, my grandfather nursed his anger and amused himself by planning the conquest of Washington. For verisimilitude, he enacted his role of Reichsmarschall in his grandfather's Pressburger German, debating strategy with the added relish its glottals afforded. He ordered that crack commando units be trained to crew U-boats. He landed 300 men on the Patuxent at the spot where the British had begun their invasion of 1814. His submarine Jaegers blew up the Potomac bridges and electrical power stations, seized radio towers, cut telegraph and telephone cables. They entrenched the orderly street grid with grenade craters and razor wire, piled up chicanes across the approaches to the city. 30 men sufficed to take the Capitol, a dozen to seize the White House. By the evening of the second day of his invasion, my grandfather stood in jackboots and piqued Schirmutz at the elbow of FDR, proffering his pen for the formal surrender. He returned to Fort Belvoir that evening, alarmed by the clarity and elegance of his plan. Before retiring for the night, he formulated its essentials in a typed 3-page memorandum to his CO, which was afterward mislaid, ignored, or possibly forgiven. In the darkness of the dormitory room he shared with an MIT-educated civil engineer named Orland Buck, he laid out the scheme again. By pure chance, this Buck happened to be one of the few officer candidates not readily fitted onto my grandfather's 3-part schema of humanity. Orland Buck was a Maine Brahmin whose father and grandfather both had died fighting to build heroic bridges in Argentina and the Philippines. A history of raising hell in genteel institutions and the weight of his patrimony inclined Buck to the arts of demolition, and he zeroed in on that element of my grandfather's plan. One bridge would do, he decided. Make it the Francis Scott Key, and you would get their attention all right. Weeks passed without any acknowledgment of my grandfather's memorandum. Orland Buck and my grandfather spent their leave hours ostentatiously casing the Francis Scott Key Bridge with its arches and elegant cavalcade. Buck took documentary pictures of my grandfather taking pictures, unmolested, of the bridge's piers and abutments. Despite their efforts, no one questioned or even appeared to remark on the young men's fascination with the bridge, built by the Corps in the 20s, engineered by an associate of Buck's father. In demolition training sessions, the Corps daily broadened their expertise, and at night, Buck and my grandfather studied official copies of the bridge's construction plans in the base library. "It will teach them a lesson," Buck said, lying on his bunk in the darkness. A radio, tuned low, brought news of Rommel's capture of Tobruk. "It will serve the bastards right." My grandfather wondered how long ago, without his having noticed, his bunkmate had passed from the conditional to the future in talking about their plan. He didn't believe for a moment that Buck wanted to teach anyone a lesson, or had the slightest interest in seeing justice done. Buck was not a sorehead, a perfectionist, or a nurser of grievances. He was in it for fun, and only saying what he thought my grandfather wanted to hear. "Don't get carried away," my grandfather told him. "Who, me?" In a strong box at the back of an old Mack truck that stood rusting without engine or wheels under a tarp in the motor pool, Buck and my grandfather had stashed 10 bombs of their own manufacture. The bomb's design was plausibly straightforward and effective. Empty wooden ammo boxes stuffed with gun cotton, which Buck and my grandfather had spirited away in amounts small enough to go unnoticed during demolitions training. A small amount of primer and Cortex had been obtained in the same way, just enough for my grandfather to make his point harmlessly. Twisted to the end of each coil of Cortex was a note typed by my grandfather that read, "Nur zu Demonstrationszwecken." "I don't like it when people get carried away," my grandfather said. "Oh, no, neither do I," Buck said shamelessly. On the night appointed for the exploit, they strapped on tool belts, retrieved their store of demonstration bombs from the strong box, zipped the bombs into 4 duffel bags, and went AWOL with an ease that bore out my grandfather's contempt for the way things were done at Fort Belvoir. They hiked through tall weeds and trash pine,
across a service road and into some woods that had been part of the original Belvoir plantation. They stumbled, cursing, in the dark of the forest until they came to the tracks of the RF&P, where they hopped a freight and rode an empty flatbed into Alexandria. They jumped off just before the train entered the rail yard, in a neighborhood of low brick houses. From the Potomac yard came a smell of diesel, an ozone scorch of pantograph sparkings. Those smells and the houses, with their puzzled expressions, stirred old yearnings and rancors in my grandfather's heart. He wondered, as in the past and for years to come, if this might be the night on which his life, his true life, began at last. They found an old Model A pickup parked in an alley. The rear window glass of its cab had been replaced by a sheet of pegboard. My grandfather stove in the pegboard with a jab of his left elbow and wiggled through. He had never hot-wired a car before, but the principle was trivial, and the Ford unresisting. It took him under a minute to turn the engine over. He unlocked the door and slid across to the passenger side. Orland Buck got in behind the wheel and pawed it for a second or two.
"You bastard," Orland Buck said happily. "God damn you."
"Drive."
A body slammed against the truck on Buck's side. Buck's window was filled with the eyes and red jaw of a dog. A man shouted from a house that backed onto the alley. Orland Buck laughed. He fought against the clutch and the gear shift. They lurched out of the alley under escort from the outraged dog before Buck hit the gas, and they left the animal in their dust. The truck was not going to afford them very much in the way of stealth. As they turned onto the Jeff Davis Highway, it sounded like they were dragging a sack full of clocks behind them. Orland Buck took himself in hand after that. He drove with care in the darkness, meeting the speed limit. They drove past the new airport, past the wasteland, where they were putting up the new War Department building, past the cemetery where Buck's father and grandfather lay under their white crosses. They dragged their load of clock parts across the roadbed of their intended victim and turned left on the district side. Upriver, a little way from Georgetown, near the old terminus of the C&O Canal, Buck put the truck into neutral and cut the engine. They rolled into the gravel lot of Fletcher's Boathouse. Before getting out of the truck, they blackened their faces with burnt cork and pulled dark watch caps over their heads. Orland Buck was in heaven. My grandfather was obliged to admit that he was also enjoying himself so far.
"Now, did you ever paddle a canoe?"
said Buck, a veteran of many Down East camps.
"I've seen it done," my grandfather said, thinking in particular of a silent version of the last of the Mohicans he had taken in at the Lyric in Germantown. "If Bela Lugosi can do it, I can do it."
The hasp on the boathouse door broke at a tap of his hammer and chisel. My grandfather eased the door open a foot on its rollers and slipped inside. The darkness smelled of old canvas tennies. Buck found the canoe, Lucky Number 9, in which a War Department typist named Irma Budd once sucked him off. Bowed and loping, they ran it down to the boat ramp. My grandfather loaded in the duffel bags while Buck fetched two paddles.
"Ready to have some fun, Lugosi?"
My grandfather dragged his canoe to the bottom of the ramp and climbed into the stern as the hull scraped, then slid free. It was not the type of question he would ever bother to answer. In Canoe Number 9, silent as Piscataways, they breasted the Potomac. This was the part of the exploit that would expose them most to public view, and they had decided it would be better to get across and hug the Virginia bank, in those days still half wilderness. Adventure silenced Orland Buck. It brought out in him the sober-sided Yankee, two wiry hands on a wooden shaft. For most of the crossing, my grandfather was as useless as a Hungarian actor, though he did not give way to distress or embarrassment. By design, they had chosen a moonless night, but the weather was clear, and over my grandfather's head the circuitry of heaven was printed in bright joints of solder. By the time Buck brought them around for the short downstream run to the Key Bridge, my grandfather was handling his own paddle with aplomb. He was as happy as he had ever been. The bridge seemed to hold itself in tension, straining at its tethers as Orland Buck and my grandfather slid beneath its haunch. It thrummed with the passage of a car overhead. My grandfather shipped his paddle and crouched, rocking the canoe a little as Buck eased them to the foot of the abutment that buried its massive burden in the soil of Virginia. Buck reached out to steady the boat. My grandfather zipped open one of the duffel bags and took out the first bomb and a roll of adhesive tape they had boosted from the infirmary. Given time and actual malicious intent, they would have holed the concrete with a pick or borer to sink the bombs, to give the blasts some muscle. Concrete was a bastard, and my grandfather estimated that to bring the key bridge down in earnest might take 1,000 pounds of gun cotton. He taped the first bomb to the bridge's great concrete hoof. The strips of sticky tape, as he unrolled them, resounded in the arch like thunder cracks. "Next," he said. Orland Buck stroked at the water, and they went farther in under the bridge. The water slapped against the canoe and against the abutment. The Francis Scott Key Bridge has 5 arches, 3 that take giant steps across the water, 1 at either end to anchor the bridge to land. Orland Buck and my grandfather took turns taping 3 bombs to each of the 4 central piers, 6 bombs per man. When they had finished, it was nearly 4 in the morning. My grandfather looked up at the belly of the bridge. He admired the way the gap between the top of each arch and the flat bridge deck was taken up by a series of daughter arches. Each inverted U obliged to descend farther from the deck than the last as the mother arch curved down and away. The whole space hummed as the wind passed through it. Beyond the vault of steel and concrete, the vernal animals and heroes wheeled in the greater vault of the sky. Arch upon arch upon arch, bearing up, craving the weight, crushed by the force that held it together. He looked down at Orland Buck in the stern of the stolen canoe. Buck was holding a time pencil and a 150-foot coil of cordex my grandfather had never seen and knew nothing about. "You probably want to grab a paddle and put some distance between here and this boat," said Orland Buck. My grandfather nodded. On some level, he had suspected Buck was planning something of this nature. He sat down and deftly turned the canoe upstream. Buck paid out the coated cord with 1 hand, taking care not to dislodge the detonator pencil. When they had gone about 140 feet along the bank of the district side, my grandfather swung the paddle up out of water and ensured that it made solid contact with the side of Orland Buck's head. Buck fell onto his face. My grandfather twisted the time pencil free of the cordex and tossed it into the river. He sat Buck up, made sure that his friend was unconscious and not dead, and laid him out in the stern of the canoe. Then he paddled back to Fletcher's. When they got there, Buck was still out cold. My grandfather returned the canoe to the shed by himself, leaving $3 to pay for the broken hasp. He shoved the empty duffel bags into a trash bin and loaded Buck into the cab of the stolen truck. When they were crossing the Key Bridge, Orland Buck made a noise and opened his eyes. He looked out the window and saw where they were. He experimented with his fingers at the sight of his injury and groaned again. He shook his head.
"Christ," he said with bitter respect.
"You got carried away," said my grandfather. The next afternoon, when my grandfather returned to quarters after maps and surveying, there was an MP stationed on either side of his door. My grandfather braced himself to flee, and then accepted his fate as it bore down on him. His cheeks, ears, and inner organs burned at the thought that his mother would now be obliged to let those 2 bakers shit on her head for the rest of her life. The snowdrops in their spotless helmets held still as he approached them. They stared death, hatred, and tedium at him, and my grandfather stared those things back. "Looking for me?" he said, stopping in front of the door, equidistant to each of their throats. "No, son," said a voice from inside the room where he and Orland Buck had foolishly conspired to land themselves. My grandfather presumed in Leavenworth. It was a rich man's voice, lilting and soft but accustomed to being listened to. "I'm the one that's looking for you." A big man, past middle age, sprang up from the chair when my grandfather walked in. Broad at the shoulder like my grandfather, a
Bruiser gone old and fat. He wore a gray Glen plaid suit, gridded with red, a red and silver silk tie, and wonderful black bucks. Though he looked like an English lawyer, my grandfather could smell the army on him. The man took the measure of my grandfather coldly and openly, top to bottom. What he saw appeared to confirm report, or rumor. His eyes were extraordinary. Remembering them to me, my grandfather groped to define their color, comparing them first to sea ice, then to a lit stove ring. "I'm sure it will come as no surprise to you, soldier," the man said in his Park Avenue drawl, "to learn that you are in trouble."
"No, sir."
"No, indeed. How could it? You went looking for trouble, and you found it. Consistent behavior produces predictable results."
"Sir, I wasn't looking for trouble. I
don't bother to deny it. One glance at you, and I know the whole story. You've been looking for trouble all your life."
"Sir,
am I wrong, soldier?"
"No, sir."
"You stole equipment and materiel from the U.S. Army, went AWOL, hot-wired a truck, purloined a canoe, planted live explosives on federal property."
"That part was not the plan," my grandfather said. "The live charge."
"No? Then how did it happen?"
It was clear that Buck had already confessed to everything. But my grandfather had not given up the whiskered girl in the train yard, and he was unwilling to give up his friend, even if his friend had turned out to be a rat.
"It was a breakdown in leadership," my grandfather confessed.
The eyes went abruptly from ice to fire. My grandfather had the disconcerting sensation of being loved by the beefy old man.
"Oily Buck's father served in the Fighting 69th as my aide-de-camp," the old man said. "He was always looking for trouble, too, and he knew that if he ever called out to me, I would hasten to his side and endeavor to get him out of whatever fix he was in, one way or another. I believe that is why, when those two snowdrops out there showed up to arrest him, Oily reached out to his old Uncle Bill." A seine of anecdotes, genealogies, and dark allusions, let out by Orland Buck over the past few months, cinched together all at once in my grandfather's mind and caught a darting hope.
"Colonel Donovan, can you get me out of trouble, too?" my grandfather said.
"Well, my boy,"
Wild Bill Donovan said,
"you know, the truth is, I probably could, but as we've already established, that's not what you really want now, is it?"
Chapter 5. Following his arraignment on charges of assaulting the president of Feathercombs, my grandfather spent a week in jail. The bail was steep, and he had no collateral apart from a $25 reflecting telescope and a 1949 Crosley sedan. Over that week, he telephoned my grandmother twice. In the first call, he misinformed her as to his whereabouts and said nothing at all about his arrest. The lawyer, Shulman, sent someone to pick up the Crosley from the garage on East 57th and drive it back to New Jersey. The driver was instructed to tell my grandmother only that her husband planned to go by train on an urgent sales trip upstate. On the fourth day of his stretch in the house of detention, my grandfather phoned again. He provided my grandmother with memories not previously shared from a trip the previous August. A view from a motel window overlooking the rancid Susquehanna. An Italian restaurant that had served spaghetti in a green sauce called pesto. A long afternoon making sales calls in the heat. He had hated the job from the day he was hired, but now that he had lost it, demolished it, there was a retrospective charm in the tedium of those days spent barnstorming upstate beauty counters. Tears came to his eyes as he leaned against the outgoing-only payphone in his gray jailhouse twills, eulogizing the wife of a pharmacist in Elmira, who at first had taken only a case of Feathercombs, but increased her order to three after he held up his demo mirror. He never considered telling my grandmother the truth. She was already teetering. He was afraid the truth would push her over the edge. That was how he explained his subterfuge to himself and to me, 32 years later. It was not, in my view, a complete explanation. My grandfather never would have lied to exonerate himself,
make himself look good, or evade responsibility. Unlike my grandmother, he did not seem to find pleasure or release in telling lies. But while he was a family man and loved us all in his wordless way, he was also, to the core, a solitary. If there was suffering to be endured, he preferred to withstand it alone. If he made a mess, he would clean it up, himself. Unlike his wife, he was uncomfortable with make-believe, but his fetish for self-reliance made him secretive. So, though it was true that psychiatrists, who got paid to know such things, had instructed him over the years to keep upsetting news away from my grandmother, it was also true that this advice suited his furtive nature. She was always threatening rain. He had been born with an umbrella in his hand. The truth is that if he hadn't been so worried about his wife's mental state, my grandfather might have welcomed a couple of days in jail. Repentance is the most solitary of pursuits, and there could be no better place for penitence than shelved on a steel bunk in the tombs. But scenarios of imminent breakdown and disaster at home began to obsess him. Though he hated asking for help more than anything else, in particular from people who loved him or would do it free of charge, my grandfather saw no alternative but to tell Shulman to try to track down his kid brother. Uncle Ray had been ordained as a rabbi at the age of 23, a wonder boy of learning. But sometime in the early 1950s, my great-uncle had begun to reverse himself on questions of chance and divine intention. He had resigned his pulpit in northwest Baltimore, and now made a good living hustling pool and poker up and down the Delmarva Peninsula. To raise my grandfather's veil, Ray required a week's time, a supply of willing victims, and a surprise win by Hopeless Hope in the Fifth at Hialeah. My grandfather walked out of the tombs with enough money for a shave, a bus, a Zagnut bar for my mother, and coffee and a donut for himself when he reached the Patterson bus terminal. Through Shulman, coached to represent himself to my grandmother as a lawyer involved with your husband's business, my grandfather had arranged for his wife to meet his bus at 10:30. At 11:15, there was still no sign of her. He used his last dime to call the house. "I'm here," he said.
"Here? Where is here?"
"In Patterson, at the bus."
"Patterson," she repeated.
She might have heard rumors. Her tone suggested of there being such a place. She found her adopted homeland overburdened by places with preposterous names. "Didn't Shulman tell you?"
"Shulman? Who is this Shulman?"
"The lawyer, Shulman."
"Shulman is the lawyer, yes, I see."
You would have assumed she was jotting the words down for subsequent study. "Patterson, Shulman, lawyer."
"And now tell me, please, who are you?"
Only much later did my grandfather learn there had been a story in the Daily News. But he understood now that in spite of his efforts, word had spread. "Look," he said, "I don't know what to say. I'm sorry."
"Are you? And why is that?"
"Darling, I know. I did a terrible thing. I'll sort it out, I swear. I could not be more sorry. I know how worried you must have been."
"Ah, but not in the least."
Because of her French accent, there was always a showiness to my grandmother's sarcasm.
"Every time I'm starting to worry, then I think of you jumping out of the airplane, bringing emergency hair combs to the disheveled ladies of Binghamton, New York."
He winced, recognizing in this distorted version the lameness of the cover story he had concocted with Shulman. To sell it, as she clearly understood, he had been counting on the marginality of Binghamton to his immigrant wife's disorderly mental maps. But as usual, she had seen through him and his stratagems. Like many of the spouses of the lucky ones, my grandfather had observed that what got labeled luck was really stubbornness married to a knack for observation, a fluid sense of the truth, a sharp ear for lies, and a deeply suspicious nature. They'd had the same type of luck in South Philadelphia, but there you could do more with it than merely survive. "Honey," he pleaded, "I just spent a week in jail. I'm filthy. I'm half dead. I'm in a bus station in Patterson. Please, come get me."
"You have eaten something?"
"I had a donut. How is she?"
"She is at school."
He had not asked for my mother's whereabouts.
they could be inferred from the time of day and the day of the week. But he let it pass. His question had been as pointless as any other.
"And this donut you ate," she said, "how big it was?"
"How big? It was a donut. It was donut size."
"Darling, but it filled up your stomach?"
"Sure."
"Good," she said, just before she hung up on him. "Then you will have energy for the long walk home."
He pleaded with a soldier bound for Trenton on leave and wasted the dime on another call home. My grandmother had taken the phone off the hook. For the soldier's benefit, he pretended, while listening to the busy signal, to hold a brief conversation with his wife, in which he was forgiven and redeemed. He coughed to cover the clatter as the phone returned the dime, which paid for the bus to Hohokus. They dropped him on Sheridan Avenue. He walked, surrounded for a long time, by tracts of new construction. Dirt lawns, planted saplings, houses like boxcars and snaking lines. When he drove past these new housing tracts at 45 miles per hour on his way to work every day, they had appeared harmless, contained. On foot, he could not seem to get past them. Houses oozed without limit in every direction. Cornfields, orchards, stands of oak and hickory that had seemed untouchable by time or steel had all been dragged under. My grandfather felt a stirring of unease that grew stronger the nearer to home he came. He worried that, in his absence, the ooze would have spread to overtop their white house on its little green hill. He shook off the thought. He was irritated with himself for thinking it. But as he threaded his way among the housing developments, the image returned to plague him. His house, his wife and daughter, driven beneath the ooze. At last he turned off the country road onto a road paved with gravel, and found himself safely among apple trees and shoots of corn. The panic subsided, but he could not seem to reassure himself that his family would not be drowned. The way I heard the story was that sometime after the fall of France, my grandmother, unwed, not yet 18, and pregnant with my mother, had been taken in by Carmelite nuns in the countryside outside of Lille, where her family were prominent Jewish dealers in horses and hides. On learning that she was pregnant and with the bastard of a Catholic, unappeased by knowing that the father was a handsome young doctor, her family had disowned her. It was the family of the handsome young doctor who had arranged things with the nuns. Shortly after my mother's birth, my grandmother's family was deported to Auschwitz, where they perished. After the handsome young doctor had treated the injuries of some local members of the resistance, the SS had shot him. All her life, my grandmother's family looked askance at her interest in drama, poetry, handicraft. The nuns, by contrast, were sympathetic, aesthetic. They supported themselves by making and selling fragrant wreaths of laurel and dried flowers. They tended orchards and beehives and a meadow dotted with sheep. When I was 8 or 9, my mother had explained the concept of survivor's guilt to me, and told me that in her mother's case, this was one of its sources. She had never been happier than with the sisters of the Lille Carmel. My grandparents' farmhouse, on 11 acres outside Hohokus, New Jersey, had neither nuns nor sheep. But there was a meadow and an apple orchard, and my grandfather had spent their first winter building hives and honeycomb frames, according to plans in a book from the public library. He had taken out a lease on the property in anticipation of my grandmother's discharge from her first hospitalization, from late 1952 to late 1954. He had hoped the place might carry her back to the remembered sweetness of the Carmel. The apples had proved stony. The special order French bees were prey to wanderlust and ennui. But from her first sight of the farmhouse with its gingerbread, tangle of roses, and fresh coat of whitewash, my grandmother had conceded to my grandfather's logic. She emerged from that first time at Greystone in a fragile and quiet state, holding herself like an egg balanced on a spoon. But for the next 28 months they lived on the farm in relative contentment. No angel inspired her to bear the prophecies of her body to fellow passengers on buses or trolley cars. She abandoned the bouts of prolonged fasting that rendered her skin translucent to an inner light equivalent in her mind to the Christ of her guardian nuns. She found work, taking leads in three productions at the prestigious Paper Mill Playhouse, and being cast in a small role in a Broadway revival of Ah Wilderness that closed out of town. Until the spring of 1957, the Skinless Horse had kept its jibes and railleries to itself. Sometime during the week preceding my grandfather's rampage at Feathercombs Incorporated, her cruel familiar returned to take up residence in a grand hickory tree in the house's front yard. The precise moment of its reappearance, like the reason thereof, remained unclear to my grandfather. In hindsight, he recalled my grandmother once or twice having held herself very still, eyes closed, as if fighting down a bout of nausea. He remembered a shudder that she repressed, a smile that hung too long from the hooks of her face. For all my grandfather knew, the Skinless Horse might have been hanging around for months before it decided to occupy the tree fort my grandfather had built in the hickory tree as a 13th birthday present for my mother. The day he got out of jail, the first thing he saw, coming down the hill from the main road, was the tree. It was a 60-footer, planted well before the turn of the century by the house's original occupants, a fellowship of free-love Christians. At the height of summer, it would spread its leaves across the sky like a child's drawing of a tree, a perfect circle of crayon green. Hidden among its branches, the tree fort was my mother's galleon and keep. Now at the base of the tree, there was a burnt blotch from which four jagged streaks extended upward. It looked like the print of a giant paw. The eye holes of the tree fort stared down at my grandfather as he circled around to the kitchen at the back of the farmhouse. They never used the front door. My grandfather hauled himself up the last three steps of his long walk home onto the back porch. The boards under his wingtips were new last summer. The previous porch was rotten and colonized by insects, and my grandfather had demolished it with a ferocity that approximated hope. Working alone or with my mother passing him nails from a bucket, or bracing a plank with her bottom, she had cut, framed, and whitewashed the lumber of the new one, carpentering its Gothic lace under the guidance of another library book. The new porch felt sound and solid under the weight of him. Like the rest of the house, it was not and would never be his property. But in those years his ambition was not to own a piece of the world. Just to keep that piece from falling down or burning up around him would suffice. The spring afternoon had turned cool, but the back door was open. My grandfather smelled onions, bay leaf, simmering wine. He heard the Trout Quintet bubbling on the record player in the living room. The kitchen windows streamed with vapor. Behind them darted the shape of my grandmother. She was an excellent cook, never more calm or present than with her hand on the rosewood grip of a razor-sharp sabatier. In the early 50s, before her first hospitalization, she had been a frequent guest on WAAM's Home Cooking, giving lessons in French cooking to Baltimore housewives, those with televisions at any rate, and briefly the host of her own program, La Cuisine, which aired two mornings a week. "Look who's here," my grandfather said, coming into the heat of the kitchen. She looked up from her bowl and whisk. She reached around to untie her apron. She had set her hair and put on her pearls. The pearls lay against the ruddy expanse between her throat and the cleft revealed by the scoop neck of her black sweater. The pearls seemed to radiate the absorbed heat of her skin. My grandparents forgave each other with the pragmatism of lovers in a plummeting airplane. There would be ample time for reproach in the event of their survival. "We have an hour before the school bus," my grandmother said. My grandfather took off the shoes, his suit and tie, his curdled white shirt, his socks and garters. My grandmother helped him out of his undershorts. She led him naked up to the bathroom so he could wash away the tombs. Hot water was a pleasure, but he did not linger under the shower. When he came into the bedroom, my grandmother had unfurled her naked body on the bed, propped on an elbow. Knowing that he liked the look of it, she had retained the string of pearls. A photograph of my grandmother posed in a bikini taken in Florida when she was in her mid-40s shows a Zoftig dame with impressive cleavage and dimpled knees. By then, she had undergone the first-generation hormone replacement therapy, HRT, that softened her body and pacified her mind. When she took my grandfather into her arms on the afternoon of his release from the house of detention, her abdomen was rounded and firm under the watered silk of her stretch marks. Her waist remained narrow, her wrists and ankles thin. He took one ankle and used it to drag her across the bed. He pinned her upraised legs against him and entered her with his feet planted on the floor. The pearls shone against her skin in the failing daylight. As he was getting up from the toilet one morning in March 1990 in the master bathroom of his condominium at the Fontana Village Retirement Community in Coconut Creek, Florida, my grandfather heard something snap. He woke up bloody on the bathroom floor with a fat lip and a leg fracture. Later, the broken bone would prove to be the result of a bone metastasis. It turned out that for the past 6 months, without telling anyone, he had been declining to undergo treatment for a carcinoid tumor in his gut. But at first, all we knew was that he had fallen, and that someone would have to look after him as he recovered from a broken leg. My mother, a public interest litigator, was in the midst of bringing a class action suit against a pharmaceutical company whose popular second-generation HRT drug appeared to be giving thousands of women ovarian cancer and killing them before they turned 60. My younger brother, embarked on a career as an actor in L.A., had just booked a TV pilot, a proposed reboot of the 70s show Space 1999. I was about to start a reading tour for the paperback edition of my first novel, and was in the midst of an attempt, which turned out to be futile, to salvage something more than the material for a few short stories from the staved-in hull of my first marriage. There was also the shadowy lady friend. Pooling information, we discovered that my grandfather had said little to any of us about her. Her name was Sally. She was an artist. She was a recent widow. None of us had a phone number or even knew her last name. Sally called my mother on the day after my grandfather's accident and got right to the point. Though she and my grandfather had been dating only since September and were still getting to know each other, she was willing to help. But she had spent 3 brutal years nursing her late husband through his illness, decline, and recent death, and frankly, she was not sure she had the strength. My mother thanked Sally and said she understood. She had the sense that Sally already knew my grandfather well enough to imagine that he might not take to being nursed. So my mother flew to Florida to fetch the man who had been her father since she was not yet 5 years old. She hoped that by bringing him to Oakland, she would be able to arrange for his care and whatever therapy he needed and still be able to do her job. She booked him a first-class seat, over his strenuous objections, for the long trip west so that he would be more comfortable. She arranged for his mail to be forwarded and packed a suitcase with his clothes and papers. It was a big suitcase with plenty of room for personal items, but my grandfather chose to bring only 5. 1. Rockets, Missiles, and Space Travel by Willie Ley, 3rd edition, Viking, 1957. A History of Rocket Flight up to 1956, combined with a detailed, if ultimately mistaken, prognostication of a manned mission to the moon. I knew the book and its author were longtime favorites of my grandfather, but I had never seen this particular copy. It lacked a dust jacket and bore clear evidence, tape stains, a tear on the paste down where a pocket for the date card had been, New York State Department of Corrections, rubber stamped along the top edge of its provenance. When I flipped through its pages, I noticed that throughout the book, someone, presumably my grandfather, had used a black marker to blot out certain words. I held up the defaced pages to the bedside lamp. Every blot covered an occurrence of one man's name, Werner von Braun. 2. A Zippo, known as Auenbau's lighter, which he had carried in his right pants pocket for as long as I could remember. He had quit smoking before I was born, but I'd seen him use Auenbau's lighter many times to light charcoal grills, chimney logs, campfires. On a smooth oval set into a nickel finish, otherwise pebbled to hide scratches, you could make out traces of an engraved representation of an organic molecule, a linked pair of hexagons, whose vertices were C's, H's, and O's. Over the years, I had asked him a few times what molecule was represented, but the answer I received, maltose, or the reason for the answer, because it makes donuts taste good, struck me as so nonsensical and seemed to explain so little, my grandfather didn't even like donuts, that I finally concluded he was putting me on. As for the Zippo's eponym, my grandfather would only say that Alan Bao had been an army buddy. 3. A black-and-white photograph of my mother taken in August 1958. In the photo, she was sitting bareback on a lean gray horse. She wore a beach towel around her hips and a one-piece swimsuit that she filled out more thoroughly than might be advisable for a girl not yet 16. She and the horse were angled away from the photographer, looking to his left. My mother held an archery bow with an arrow nocked to the drawn bowstring, ready to let fly at a target out of a frame. I'd never seen the photo before it showed up among my grandfather's belongings. Neither he nor my mother would say much about it except that it had been taken at a hotel in Virginia Beach, during the period of her life when she was remanded to the custody of Uncle Ray. My mother's hair was unkempt, and the look in her eyes, taking aim, struck me as murderous. 4. A model moon garden constructed from the lid of a to-go coffee cup, pieces salvaged from commercial model airplane and tank kits, a dozen small capacitors, and four links of a metal wrist watch band glued together and spray-painted Tamiya Light Ghost Gray. It belonged to LAV-1, my grandfather's scale model lunar outpost, which he had spent the years since my grandmother's death building and reconfiguring. With its tunnels, pods, aerials, dishes, and domes, the LAV-1 model, on its craggy scale model lunar surface, covered most of the dining room table in his condo back in Florida. He only wanted the moon garden, my mother told me. I had to kind of tweeze it out from the rest of it. 5. A publicity photograph in a Lucite box frame of the last crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger. In this photograph, astronauts Michael J. Smith, Dick Scobee, and Ronald McNair sat at a table with their helmets in front of them like fishbowls, from which they planned to draw lucky numbers. Behind them stood Ellison Onitsuka, Krista McAuliffe, Gregory Jarvis, and Judith Resnick, cradling their helmets in their hands. The crew's flight suits, like the shiny cloth that covered the table, were a variation on the blue of the Florida sky in which they would soon be lost. Their seven smiles mocked them, at least to my eye. At one end of the blue table, like a human skull in a still life, stood a scale model of Challenger strapped to its fuel tank and booster rockets. In the photograph, the model shuttle looked like a child's toy, albeit a splendid one. It was hard to see the fine detail that my grandfather had put into this particular commission, how the cargo bay doors opened to reveal the remote manipulator arm, how the engine nozzles could be made to pivot. You could pull open the nose of the fuselage and look into the crew cabin, rendered in faithful detail down to the buttons and switches of the instrument panels and the Sally Ride curtain over the toilet. Even if his scale model had not been selected by NASA for inclusion in the official mission portrait, my grandfather likely would have planned to attend the launch on January 28, 1986. He was a habitué of Cape Canaveral, who drove up for almost every shuttle firing, as if trying to make up for his boycott, painful to him to have to maintain, I knew, of every Apollo mission. But that Tuesday corresponded to the 11th yard site of my grandmother's death. At 11:39 a.m., when an O-ring failed and the shuttle began to break apart, my grandfather was at her grave in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. He didn't learn of the disaster until he got back to his motor lodge in Center City and turned on the television. He sat, without moving, without blinking or breathing, as a flower of fire bloomed on a stem of vapor. In that and subsequent replays, he watched fragments of the disintegrated spacecraft snake across the sky, wandering, doubling back, as if blindly searching for one another in the blue. As soon as I heard the news, I was then in graduate school at UC Irvine, I tracked him down through my mother. I had expected that when I reached him, my grandfather might sound low, even mournful. But I ought to have known better.
"Too goddamn cold," he said. 36 degrees at launch, idiot bureaucrats."
"Why didn't I scrub it?"
"Because they're pencil pushers. Judy knew better than to launch in weather like that."
The astronaut Judith Resnick was a particular favorite of my grandfather's. She was a brilliant engineer who had, on a prior mission, become the first Jewess in space. Her tangle of wild black curls had enacted Medusa feats in zero gravity.
"Poor Judy,"
my grandfather said. I could hear the voice of a television reporter in the background, shouting to be heard over the wind gusting along a stretch of Florida beach.
"I'm sorry I couldn't be with you," I said. "How was it?" "How was the cemetery?"
"Dumb question."
"It was very festive."
"I'm sorry."
"Frankly, the grave looked untidy. I was shocked."
The wind whipped up along the beach on the motel TV.
"Grandpa, you there?" "Yeah."
"You okay?"
"No."
"I know you miss her. I wish she were still here."
"I'm glad she isn't. She saw what a mess her grave is. She'd be furious, and she'd blame me because I insisted on that cemetery."
"Oh."
"Everyone else is already buried there. It was already paid for a long time ago."
I knew my grandfather didn't mean that he was glad my grandmother had died. I knew how much he missed her. I didn't know because he had not yet told me that inside the crew cabin of his Challenger model, one of the webbed panels enclosing the sleep niches could be lifted on a hinge to reveal two miniature human figures. They had been the original occupants of LAV-1's moon garden before my grandfather enlarged the scope of that structure's function. A man and a woman, 5/8 of an inch tall, lay together in a sleep niche, naked in each other's arms. The male figure spread his body like a shield across the female. The female figure's long hair was painted a vivid shade of auburn. My grandfather never revealed the intention behind this Easter egg, not to me at least. It may have been a gag, or never one to let an empty grave or a $3.99 model kit go to waste. My grandfather may simply have been economizing. When I look at the Challenger mission photograph now, I don't see the seven smilers, pretty Judy Resnick, or even really the model itself. I see the hidden lovers, fates entangled like their bodies, waiting for release from the gravity that held them down all their lives. She touched his leg, and he woke up. The world around him was his bedroom and not a jail cell. My grandmother was taking her skirt and sweater from the valet on which she had neatly hung them. 10 minutes, she said. My grandfather put on a blue work shirt and a pair of chinos and went downstairs to find his mud-caked work boots. My grandmother had resumed work on her interrupted coq au vin. She stood at the stove with her head inclined over a wooden spoon that brimmed with steam. He came up behind her and touched his lips to her nape. She shivered. He felt that she expected him to say something. They had spoken very little so far, and he was not sure what he meant to say or what she needed to hear. He wrestled fiercely against the urge to say nothing at all. In his powerlessness to undo what had already been done or avert what lay ahead, he resorted to the usual inanity.
"We'll be fine," he told her. "It'll all be fine."
She did not contradict him, did not assent. She took a sip from the spoon. She made a sound that committed her to nothing.
"Go," she said. "She is expecting to see you."
My grandfather waited at the top of the drive to meet the school bus, ready with the Zagnut bar. The sky was promisingly blue. To occupy himself, my grandfather constructed an almanac of nights lost to the House of Detention. The moon would be at 3/4 and waning. Tonight, after he had eaten his wife's good coq au vin and dried and put away the dishes, he and my mother would rejoin Oliver Twist in his interminable sufferings. My grandfather would lie beside his daughter and then his wife, in turn, until their breathing gathered into sleep.
Then he would go to the top of the hill behind the house with his telescope and a thermos of tea and lose himself for an hour or two in contemplation of the Sea of Serenity, Algol and Deneb, Eridanus, the River of Stars. "It will all be fine," he said aloud. When the bus pulled up, he watched my mother, 14 and lanky, slouch her way along the aisle down the steps. When her feet touched ground, she burst into a run. He pressed his nose against her hair and breathed in her school smell, a smell like the flavor of a postage stamp. Against her better judgment, he persuaded my mother to devour the entire candy bar before they got to the bottom of the drive, where the hickory tree fingered the sky, awaiting my grandmother's next attempt on its life. The candy bar spoiled my mother's appetite for dinner, but in the interest of peace, not wanting to betray my grandfather, she forced herself to clean her plate. Chapter 6. My grandfather saw my grandmother for the first time in February 1947 at Ahavas Shalom Synagogue. She had been posed beside a potted palm in a fox stole and sunglasses, under a banner that read, "Try Your Luck." The fur was on loan from the president of the sisterhood. The dark glasses had been provided free of charge by the president's husband, an ophthalmologist, to treat a case of photophobia brought on by chronic malnutrition. I assume that the text painted on the bedsheet banner, part of the decor for Congregation Ahavas Shalom's inaugural Night in Monte Carlo, was coincidence. The pose, however, had been calculated with utmost strategy. Without consulting her, the sisterhood had decided that even though she was a widow encumbered with a 4-year-old daughter, my grandmother, transferred safely to Baltimore from a DP camp in Austria, was the leading candidate for the position of wife to the new rabbi. Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society canteens, and then the kitchens of Park Circle and Forest Park, had conspired to ensure that my grandmother regained her shape, her color, and what the president always referred to as that gorgeous head of hair. My grandmother was courteous, conversant with literature and art. She had ambitions and the talent, it was said, to be an actress on the stage. Her feline face and French accent, at times impenetrable, led more than one admirer to compare her to Simone Simon. In spite of suffering and loss, she laughed often, smiled easily. She strode into rooms with actressy shoulders and the humble swagger of a girl who had come of age among hard-working nuns. A few times, it was true, she had come out with utterances that made no sense whatsoever, in French or English. It was also true that when she was not smiling, she fell into taut silences, seemed to listen for footsteps on the other side of doors, studied shadows in the corners of rooms. When taken to a Baltimore public library for the first time, it was reported she had made straight for the recordings of Highland Reels. The first two peculiarities were put down to her being a relative newcomer to English, and a girl who had endured and survived the unspeakable. Nobody could account for the love of bagpipes. If one sometimes sensed a weird crackle around her, a scorching like dust on a solenoid, it was believed by the sisterhood, and seconded by many of their husbands, that this mysteriously added to her allure. The new rabbi, freshly graduated first in his class from the Jewish Theological Seminary, had charmed everyone with his brilliance and élan, his tailored suits and his faint, delicious odor, unexpected in a rabbi, of gardenias. But he displayed a troubling streak of self-will. All his life he had been the pride of his family and the joy of his teachers. As a result, he had learned to prefer his own ideas to those of other people, even with regard to subjects such as the woman he ought to marry, about which he could be expected to know very little. Overt matchmaking attempts, each to a thoroughly eligible candidate, had not turned out well. The sisterhood caucused and agreed to authorize the use of wiles. To ensure that the target of the operation could not fail to notice her when he put in his scheduled appearance at Night in Monte Carlo, the sisterhood had posed my grandmother beside the rented palm tree just by the main door of the synagogue's reception room. Two sisterhood members were deployed here to pin my grandmother down. Mrs. Waxman, married to a judge,
had been the chief sponsor of my grandmother's petition for refugee status. Mrs. Zellner, among the first Jewish graduates of Bryn Mawr, spoke excellent French. Playing on my grandmother's sense of obligation and her hunger to speak her mother tongue, the women were prepared to hold